teenagers who went to prom last night, happy morning after. Glad that you're here. You know, sometimes you just do things that are insensitive and you don't know it. When you post your pictures from prom, you ought to understand there are people that are sitting at home in their stained pajamas. They just turned 39. The kids are crying. One fell into the table. You got to understand what it does to us to remember that our youth is so far in the rearview mirror, and then you got to go shave, and you got to see all the white hair, and you just sometimes. All I'm saying is you're just sometimes insensitive, and you just don't understand that you're being insensitive. We're looking at Esther chapter 5 and chapter 7. This is the third series. Is Rachel, had you planned to read? Okay. Didn't look like you'd planned to read. All right, the passages will be on the screen. Rachel, if you'll read those for us.
Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court that she found favor in his sight, and the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter, and the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you, up to half the kingdom." So Esther answered, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him." And the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. At the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? It shall be granted to you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom. It shall be done." Then Esther answered and said, "My petition is and request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther. And on the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom. It shall be done." Then Queen Esther answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he, and where is he? Who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" And Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." So Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. When the king returned from the palace garden to the palace of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, "Will he also assault the queen while I am in the house?" As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." And the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided.
So we've been looking at the book of Esther, and this is a very unique book because God is all through this book. The hand of God is everywhere, but the name of God is never mentioned. There's really not even the phrase prayer in there. It mentions how they fasted, and we assume that they would have fasted and prayed for 3 days, but even that isn't really in the text. But again, God's hand is everywhere in this text. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we preached up, and I think the sermon title, as I recall, I ought to remember my own sermon title. But it seems to me that the title was The Hidden Purposes of God. And oftentimes the purposes of God are hidden. I mean, oftentimes you just can't see what God is doing when you're in the middle of the situation. You just can't sense it. And if you look at the first three chapters, I think that that's where everybody was at. King was getting drunk. The queen at that time, Vashti, was rejecting his offer to come and parade her beauty before his drunken friends. In the meantime, Esther, who is a very beautiful woman, has won the pageant, and now she's the queen of the kingdom. And all of this is coming together to bring deliverance to the children of Israel, to deliver them from the plot of Haman, which is also happening at the same time. God is preparing a way, even as he is plotting a way to kill them. But again, it's a hidden plan. You can't see this thing happening, and nobody is connecting the dots. Nobody could connect the dots in that situation, although, again, God is very much at work. But by the time you get to chapter 7, the plan isn't so hidden anymore, is it? And don't you know that the plan of God ultimately is revealed? Now, sometimes it's revealed in this life. Sometimes I think we're going to have to wait till the next life to see how all the dots truly connected. But there is a sense in which even now in the story of Esther, the plan is getting revealed. And what is it? Well, I think there are three components here, and you could make it more than that, but I'll stick to these three components. And they're happening in the life or in this story of Esther, and I think to a great degree, they really outline the plan or the purposes of God in the world in which we live, in the age in which we live. Notice one of the things that is happening here is that through very everyday situations, through an everyday situation, the evil one is being punished. And I think that you see that in the story of Haman here, don't you? He's the character, and he is plotting, and his heart is full of evil. He is out to be destructive, but God has worked a plan to bring judgment to this evil person. And it seems to me that God is always at work in one way or another to bring judgment and punishment on those who are evil. That is part of his grand overarching plan in this time era. And it's interesting, isn't it, that he does it through really poetic justice, isn't it? I mean, here's Haman. He's built this scaffold. He's got the noose ready to hang Mordecai on. And, of course, what happens is he's hung on the noose that he prepared for somebody else. He's hung by the noose, pardon me. Have you ever noticed through the Bible how God has a sense of poetic justice? I mean, it's one of the qualities of his character that we see about everywhere we look. For instance, you look at the Garden of Eden, right? And Adam's name comes from the word dust. He's dust in Hebrew is Adamah. Adam comes from the dust. He's Adam. And he wants to be like God. He and his wife, Eve, if you eat the fruit, you'll be like God. And so they want to be like God. And instead of ascending above their humanity, the punishment is go serve the dust from which you came from. In other words, you want to go higher than you are, you're going to go lower than you are as punishment for what you did. There's a poetic justice in that, isn't there? And it's interesting that Jacob the liar gets lied to. He's the deceiver. You look at the book of Exodus, and the book of Exodus starts with the Pharaoh saying, all the boys must die. They want to kill all the boys, all the Hebrew boys. And so Moses is put in a basket. He's sent down the river. He ultimately survives. But the narrative begins with Pharaoh saying, kill all the boys. But how does the narrative end? It ends with the seventh plague where the firstborn sons of the Egyptians are killed by God. Comes full circle. It starts with the Jewish boys being killed. It starts with full circle. The punishment is the firstborn sons of the Egyptians being killed. It's a poetic justice to that, isn't there? It's interesting that David, in his sin against Bathsheba, or in his sin with Bathsheba against Uriah, her husband, he takes Uriah's wife, and really when the punishment of his sin comes to full fruition, Absalom, his son, rebels against him. David's able to get out of the city with Bathsheba, but what does Absalom do? He rapes all of David's wives. Public view. Full circle. What David did in taking the wife came full circle in his house as well. It's interesting that Saul, King Saul, sought to kill David for 10 years and carried a sword with him to kill David. And it was that sword that was used when Saul committed suicide. The sword he intended to use against David was used against himself. You think about the king of Babylon. There's a place where he's talked about in Isaiah 14. I just bring this up because it's a famous passage. It talks about Lucifer, which just means son of the morning star. It's in Isaiah 14. And from this passage, there's a whole theology about, there's an assumption that Lucifer is Satan. But that's an assumption. It doesn't say that he's Satan. But notice what it says, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, or son of the morning star. How you are cut down to the ground, you are weakened among the nations, for you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven, or I'll ascend into a godlike position, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of the congregation on the farther sides of the north. But again, notice verse 16, it says, those who see you will gaze at you and consider you. Verse 15, I should read that. He says, yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you and consider you, saying, is this the man? Notice, it's not a spirit, it's not Satan, it's the man. I don't say this to you, but look at your neighbor, you know, if you want to look at him, say, it's a man, it's a man. It's not a demon, it's a man. Who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world as a wilderness and destroyed its cities. Now, who is this? This is a king. Later on, you see that it's the king of Babylon in verse 22 and 23. But it's interesting that this king, the man who made the nations tremble, is called the son of the morning star, the king of Babylon. What happens? He wants to ascend. He wants almost a godlike status. But in Daniel chapter 4, we read about this king, because here's the king of Babylon. And it says, all those came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking around the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? In other words, he's saying, I did it all, man. I did it all. It's all me. There's an exaltation coming from him. And it says, even as he said that, there was a voice from heaven that said, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And they shall drive you from men, and you shall dwell with the beast of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and 7 times shall pass over you, and you until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. I get that. He's saying, boy, I'm one of the great guys. I'm high. I'm exalted. I did all this by myself. And God is saying, now, see, you want to be above men, I'm going to put you below men. You're going to be an animal for 7 years out in the field eating grass. It's a poetic justice with God, isn't there? Sins are punished. He is weaving a trap for the wicked. In fact, there's a place in Jeremiah chapter 2, 19. He says that the DNA of sin is that it produces its own punishment. He says to those people, he said, I won't punish you. I won't have to punish you. Your sins will punish you. Do you know that everything God has forbidden, he's forbidden for the reason that out of his love, he doesn't want you to get hurt? Everything that he forbids because it would hurt you if you did it, and it does hurt you when you do it. He's like a father with kids, right? Every rule we have for our kids except touching the remote is for their benefit. That's for my benefit. Because I don't want to have to hunt it every time I want to watch TV. But everything else is for their benefit. All that stuff about staying away from the light plugs and not going up and down the stairs. Well, yeah, not slamming the door, that's for my benefit too. But most of the stuff is for their benefit. And that's the way it is with God, isn't it? And when you break His laws, the laws break you. He didn't have anything to do with that. Per se, he just told you what not to do, and if you did it, you were going to get hurt. But even ingrained in the DNA of the laws that he gives is this principle that he is weaving a trap. He is working out a way to bring punishment on the wicked. You say, there are some wicked people in my life. There are some wicked people that I know, and it don't look like they're getting punished. Well, first of all, either you're not looking that hard or it hadn't happened yet, but it's going to happen. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay. But notice something else here. Not only is the purpose of God being revealed in that he is going to destroy this wicked one, and he is out to destroy the wicked in the end. Vengeance is his. But notice that he's also out to teach wisdom to the foolish. That's the king, right? That's the king. I mean, when he finds out that it's Haman, when Esther says he's the one who's done this, it says the king gets up angry and storms out of the room. Why doesn't he just try to throttle Haman on the spot? Because he's got a problem. He's the one who signed the document. He's the one who signed the law before he read it. He's the one who was dumb enough to trust this guy, and he signed the law, and he sent out the law, and his own wife here, his own queen, is going to be killed as a result of this law, potentially, and he can't get the law back. It's gone out, and he's the one who's done it. And I think it's anger that drives him out of that room saying, how could I be so stupid? And how now am I going to fix this mess that I created? Because I wasn't diligent in my duties. And God is out to teach the foolish wisdom. He's out to do that in my life. He's out to do that in your life. And sometimes it can be very painful to learn needed lessons. It was for the king. It's often that way for you and I too, isn't it? I remember hearing Steve Renick tell a story, and he told it in a very touching manner, and I can't tell it with the same impact that he told it. But Steve Renick was in Kenya. He was a missionary, but in his post as a missionary, he was a seminary president. And he said that he had a couple visit from the States, and they wanted to give the seminary $35,000, which was a significant sum. And so he received that $35,000. They wrote the check while they were there. They went back. And then a year later, they came back to see the results of how that $35,000 had been spent. And so Steve Renick showed them what had happened. They had built a significant dormitory for their students. And he said, we stood on the porch of the cottage that they were staying in. And the man turned around and put his hands in the doorway. And he said, from what I could tell, he was sobbing. He had his back to me and he was sobbing. And he turned around and looked at me. And he said, I'm trying to apologize. I'm saying, you know, it's going to be nicer. We're not finished yet. We'll get some plants out. It'll be nice. Don't worry about it. And he said, what would $70,000 have done here? And Steve Renick said, well, we built the dormitory. We would have been able to build another wing of classrooms, which we need. That's what we could have done with the other $35,000. And then the man began to tell his story. He said, we invested a few thousand dollars in some stocks, some .com stocks. You're going back. He said, and the few thousand dollars that we invested grew to $700,000. He said, and we intended to tithe that, but $35,000 was a lot of money. So instead of giving 10% to you, the Lord told us to give 10%. We just gave you 5%. He said, and in the last year, the bubble has burst. And of that $700,000, we don't have any of it left. He said, the only thing we have to show for that $700,000 is that dormitory wing right there. And he said, we were so foolish. We were so greedy. And look what's come of our greed. And Steve Renick said, you know, in that moment, he said, I couldn't do anything but agree with him. Yeah, you were greedy. That money could have done so much. Sometimes learning wisdom is painful. Sometimes having the bonds that grip our heart, the greed and the envy and the hatred and the strife and the things that are in our life that we know we need to drive out, but we refuse to drive out for whatever reason. Getting them out of our heart, teaching us the right path, can be very, very painful. Can be very painful. But God is out to teach those who are foolish wisdom. And oftentimes it's through very painful surgeries in their life. But notice something else. He's out to bring punishment on the wicked. He's out to teach the foolish wisdom. But he's also out to save the faithful. He's out to save the faithful. That's one of his great purposes in life, in his scheme of things. And notice, that's through Esther, isn't it? I mean, Haman's getting the punishment, the king's getting wisdom, but Esther and her people are getting deliverance through what God is doing. Now, I want you to see something that's very important to see in this passage, that God is delivering the people, God is delivering Esther, but it is through her becoming a co-worker with him in the delivery process. In other words, the delivery hasn't just come through her prayers alone, but through her action, through her courage, and through her willingness to use her giftedness in the situation. And you have to understand that that's the way God always works. When he decided to deliver the children of Israel, he sent a person. He sent Moses. And if Moses hadn't gone, he would have sent someone else in Moses' spot. He will always send a person. Every person who ever comes to God, every person who is ever touched by God in some meaningful way, there's always a human thumbprint in that situation. Listen to me. When God chooses to save the world, he says the fields are white in the harvest. I want to save the world, and I'm hoping and praying that somebody else will want to join me in the mission, and they'll go out into the harvest field. The things that you want in your life will come through prayer, but they will come through you being a co-laborer with God himself. It's just not going to come through you casually praying about it. This deliverance did not come that way. First of all, again, Esther had to get up and she had to go to work. Now, it's interesting that the Jews, if you go back to chapter 3, they're weeping, they're wailing, they're sorry, they're crying out. And I think that I would have probably been one of those. I mean, when the command goes out that the Jews are going to be killed, and you're a Jew, I mean, that's got to hit you like a ton of bricks. It's like, this is awful, this is terrible, we can't escape, my family is dead, and this is a tremendously horrible situation, and they do just what anybody else do. They sit down and they cry. Esther, I think, wants to do that, but Esther has to finally get up, and she has to go to work. And you and I, to see the complete fulfillment of God's deliverance in this world and the complete fulfillment of God's purposes in my life and in your life, at some point you have got to get up and go to work. I mean, listen to me. Many of you come to receive. Each week you come to receive. And praise the Lord, you come anticipating coming to receive. But you got to understand, a lot of other people just, they don't come just to receive, but they come to give and to serve. And we need people who want to come and receive, but we also need people who want to come and serve and work. Because the purposes of God for this church is that we maximize our impact in our community for Him. And if we want to maximize our impact for Him, if we want to build a church where disciples are being made and people who have never heard about God are coming to God, where children are getting established in the faith and our children's program and youth program just aren't creating nice little people, but they are creating dedicated people to God, there's work to be done. There's work to be done. It's my prayer that the Lord would speak to teenagers in this room even now and tell you there is work to be done. God wants to do something in this world. He wants to save more people than we want to see saved. And He wants you to go to work to help do it. And I wish that while you're picking out prom dresses and tuxedos and as you're thinking about college and as you're thinking about who am I going to marry, that it would also come into your mind, how am I going to best serve God with my life? I wish some middle-aged people wouldn't be so busy. I know you're busy. A lot of it's your fault too. A lot of it's your fault. I was reading a statistic that in 1960, the average house in America was 1,200 square feet, had three bedrooms and one bath, and the average family had one car. The reason I'm busy sometimes and you're busy is you don't want 1,200 square feet and one bathroom. But that's your fault. That's not God's fault. And I know you're busy. And I know you got a lot of stuff and you got a lot of stuff to do, but I wish that the Lord could get a hold of your heart and say, you know what? Are you going to spend these productive, influential years of your life accumulating things and doing things that you can't take to heaven with you? Or are you going to spend it? Are you going to join me in the harvest? Are you going to get up and just not pray, Lord, help this church, Lord, save some people, but actually get in there and do something? I wish there were some older folks here today who were not content to spend the remainder of their life out the pasture. I wish you were. I wish that the spirit of Caleb, who at 80 years old said, I'm going to take another mountain for the Lord, would grip you. And you would not be content to stop and to quit, because Jesus didn't stop and quit for you. He went all the way to the cross. He went all the way to Calvary. And you can go all the way to the end for Him. You don't have to go to pasture. I wish you'd get up and you'd go to work. I wish you would. We got a lot of things back there on that board. We need people to help our kids. We need people to help our youth. I wish somebody would get up and make an investment for the Lord. Listen to me. I don't know that the Lord honors a lot of what we do. You know what? I think a lot of the stuff in churches that die, they die. You know why stuff dies? Because the Lord ain't blessing it. You know why stuff dies? Because the Lord ain't blessing it. If the Lord was blessing it, it wouldn't be dying. It wouldn't need to be put on life support if the Lord was blessing it. You know why sometimes the Lord doesn't bless what we do? Because we don't want to go to work. I mean, if I was the Lord and I had a group of people, and it was a youth group or it was a children's group or it was an adults group, and all they wanted to do was get around and have a devotional and eat pie, I don't think I'd bless them. It's like, I'll bless you when you want to go to work. When you care about the harvest, when you care about what's going on, when you care enough to be reaching out past this group, I'll put my anointing in you and I'll put a blessing in this room. But if all you want to do is love on each other and you don't care about the sick and the dying out there and the poor and the brokenhearted, I'm not going to put a blessing on it. It needs to die. Esther said, I'm going to go to work. Go to work. They're weeping and wailing over here, but I got a job to do. And you know what? She was courageous
in doing it. Again, I'm going back to a point I made last week. She was courageous in doing it. You say, oh, I can do all things through Christ. I am more than a conqueror through Christ. Well, how are you going to be a conqueror if you're afraid of conflict? How are you going to be a conqueror if you're sitting at home? How are you going to be a conqueror through Jesus Christ if you're afraid of a fight? Now, it's funny. I went to a Church of God meeting. And, you know, you hang around with Church of God preachers. You hear a lot of the same old thing, you know. But I'm a nice guy. I don't always say what's on my mind. But this is what I'm always thinking. When I hear people say, we gotta reclaim the way the Church of God used to be. We need to reclaim the stuff, the music, the methods, all that. And I hear them say that, and I want to say, have you read the history book? Because the funny thing about the Church of God, and some of you didn't grow up in the Church of God, so let me talk to those who did for like 3 minutes, and I'll get back on something else. But funny thing about the Church of God is when you read the history book, they were cutting edge. They were cutting edge in their technology. The only thing you had was a printing press, and those guys printed stuff that went to over 100 countries. I mean, those guys used the best technology of the day, and they mastered the use of the best technology of the day, which was the printing press and mass mailing. They were masters of that. They were extremely creative in how they did ministry. One time they bought a boat called the Floating Bethel, and they floated her down the Ohio River. And their idea was, we'll get off every 30 miles, hold a prayer meeting, and we'll try to set up churches all the way down through here. We'll just take a boat down the river. Of course, it caught fire, so they had to do something else. But it was creative. The only reason that the Church of God did ordination, they didn't want to ordain ministers. They didn't want to do all that hierarchy stuff. The only reason they ended up doing ordination or issuing licenses was because they were on the train so much going all different places. And if you were a clergy member, you got a discount on the train. So they had to come up with a way to have a card so you could present it to get the discount on the train. But that's because they were out there running all over the countryside. I mean, they were extremely creative. They were extremely ambitious. You talk about the problems of a building program. They built this, the congregation grew up around the printing press, and you ended up having 200, 300, 400 people living and working while they printed this magazine, which was, again, the great technology of the day. And they were originally up in West Junction, Michigan for 12 years. They figured they'd do better, so they went all the way down to Moundsville, West Virginia. You talk about the problems of moving across town. They moved 400 miles, at least. Went to Moundsville, stayed there 8 years, thought, well, we can do better if we go back up to Anderson. They moved twice. The whole kit and caboodle, all 200, 300, 400 people just packed up and moved 200, 300, 400 miles at a time. You want to talk about a crazy level of adventure that took hold of those people. And you know what I'm about to say? Forgive me. You can't get to heaven if you have unforgiveness in your heart. So I know you'll work it out. But I have the hymn book from 1895. Here's the thing about the early Church of God. They wrote all their own music. So that hymn book, I mean, I've gone through that, and I'm sure I've missed some stuff, but you got like 300 songs, and they were all written in the last 15 years. They were the most contemporary group of people of their day. All they did was sing new songs. And again, you look at them and say, wow, we need to be, you know, we need to be like them. Yes, maybe we ought to be like them. Maybe. I'm not saying throw away the past. I'm not saying we ought not sing the hymns. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that they didn't. It's very easy to say, hey, we need to be Church of God. We need to be like the Church of God. Well, let's be like the Church of God. Let's sell the building. I'll move 400 miles. See, they were on the cutting edge. They were a courageous group of people. And listen,
the harvest goes to the courageous. The harvest goes to the courageous. Those who conquer are courageous enough to get in the conflict. Those who conquer are courageous enough to get on the front lines of the battle. And she was willing to do that. She was willing to go do something. And she was willing to be courageous about it. And then she was willing to use her gifting and her talents. What was her giftings, by the way? From what I can gather, she was a cunning person. That was her gifting. I know that's not a spiritual gift, but maybe if we had a spiritual gift, we'd call it discernment. But she's a cunning woman. But she goes to her husband, and in chapter 5, verse 8, she says, essentially, if I have found favor in your eyes. Now, when I read that, I thought, she's saying, if you think I'm good looking, you know. But I don't think she's saying that. I don't think that's a flirtatious thing she's doing there. I think what she's sort of doing is she's laying the groundwork. She's saying, you chose me, I belong to you, and our destinies are wedded. You chose me, if I found favor in your eyes, and I did, okay, we're together. And then when he gets to the place, I think she does a psychological thing, and then she also does an incredibly sound, logical argument to him. The psychological thing is she essentially plays the woman who needs saving, and she said, you know, somebody's threatened me, and you can save me. And he's like, yeah, I'll save you. But also, what she's doing is she's playing on him, because how would he look if his wife got killed and he didn't defend her? I mean, he's going to look like a weak husband. By the way, that's one of the other ironies of this book, isn't it? Because in the beginning, remember how Esther comes to be queen? The guys come around and say, you can't forgive Vashti because she ignored you. And she set a bad precedent. She's basically told you what she's going to do. She's ignored you. She's told you what you're going to do. And that's going to be bad for all the men. And then, of course, later on, he gets told what to do by Esther. It's funny how that worked out. But she's saying, listen, we're connected. We're tied together. You've got to defend me. And you chose me. And there's a cunningness in the way that she brings that about. And as it works out, he gets angry. Haman throws himself. He's begging her to save him. But when the king comes back in, awful timing for Haman. It looks like he's thrown himself on the couch and he's trying to make a pass at her. And the king drags him out and he's hung. And salvation comes to the people. God is at work, even as we speak. If we could see it clearly, and again, a lot of it's so hidden to us, but if we could see it clearly, we would see that God is working, and he is continuing to work to bring punishment upon the wicked. He is continuing to work in my life and in your life and in the world to teach the foolish wisdom. And he is working to save as many people as will come through the door. He is working to harvest the crop, to save the world. And he is calling you and I to be a part of that. He's calling us to be a part of that. But for us to be a part and for his plan to be accomplished, we have to work more than we are. We have to go to work. We have to work courageously. And we have to be willing to use our giftedness. Maybe you've got the giftedness of cunning. We'll find a way to put you to work. I don't know how we're going to do it, but there's some people we can have you talk to. There's always somebody that needs to, you know, to experience the gift of cunning. We'll call it discernment, though, so we'll baptize it in spiritual language. But you have gifts. And the way that you help in the harvest is through those gifts. I don't have a conclusion today, so let's stand up.